Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Despite publicly vowing not to resign, House Speaker Dennis Hastert has told the Wall Street Journal that he would be willing to resign over the widening congressional page scandal if it would help the battered Republican Party in elections next month. Some news items Hastert no doubt is taking into consideration. ABC News is reporting that the man at the heart of the scandal, now former Congressman Mark Foley, had what's being described as internet sex with at least one former page at the time Foley was voting on a bill from the House floor. The conservative Arlington Group is hinting that bombshells about other congressmen are on the way. And a new poll by the Wall Street Journal points to real trouble for the Republicans on November 7th. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is the Journal's national political editor, John Harwood. And John, we want to start with the fact that we think you got the only recent interview with Hastert besides one that Rush Limbaugh had. And he told Limbaugh on the radio, Hastert did, that he wasn't going to resign, but it sounds as if he wasn't so certain with you.
Well, he talked to my colleague, David Rogers, and what he told David was if he thought it would help Republicans in the election, he would consider it, but he doesn't think so. So I think in the end, he is not likely to do this, certainly not before the election. Republicans, he is concerned, and some people around him are concerned, that that would only add to the turmoil and confusion among the within the party. But certainly it's an open question, if they manage to eke out a victory in the November elections, whether or not he will return as Speaker in the next Congress.
Well, let's look at the numbers and see what they might tell us. The new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll numbers. Can you give us an overview and a nutshell?
Sure. The most significant thing relative to the Foley scandal was we had a question. We were in the field as this story was breaking. We had a question that said, of all the things that you've learned recently about the race, do they make you more or less likely to want Republicans to control the Congress? By 41% to 18%, voters said that they are feeling less inclined to have Republicans return in control of Congress. And so what that means is that the Foley news, in combination with the Bob Woodward book, State of Denial, with the controversy over the National Intelligence Estimate, all of that has put Republicans back on their heels, playing defense at a time when they really need to make up ground against the Democrats.
You write that it's perceived in some areas, this scandal in Washington, as Washington's version of the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal, and here in Boston when the Cardinal was said to sort of, you know, not react quickly enough.
Well, and yes, and you have both elements there. You have one, the conduct of the member with the teenager, and which strikes most Americans as repugnant and something that needs to be dealt with. But then you also have the question of how leaders within the party handle the allegations when they became aware of them, at least in some form, and what people around Hastert and Tom Reynolds, who heads the campaign committee, are saying, well, what we knew months ago was only the so-called over-friendly emails, but what they're facing is a real firestorm among conservatives who say you should have reacted to that as a big red flag.
You say firestorm, but no member of Congress, or maybe correct me if I'm wrong, has a member of Congress called for Hastert to resign yet? We know some social conservatives have.
No, it's mostly outside conservatives calling for this. In fact, today Mike Pence, one of the young rising conservatives within the House, somebody seen as potentially a speaker himself someday, came out and said Hastert should stay in the job. So people are being fairly cautious about that. But there's no question there's a tremendous amount of heat, and we see that reflected in the fact that you've had a lot of byplay between John Boehner, who's the Republican leader, saying that it was Hastert's responsibility, and Tom Reynolds has been saying much the same thing, the congressman who heads the campaign committee. And he faces, by the way, Robin, a very, very tough race for his own seat in Buffalo, New York.
Right. Well, Hastert and other Republicans are trying to say that the Democrats are behind the Foley email scandal. Dennis Hastert said that on the Rush Limbaugh program. But the ABC News investigative reporter who broke the story says he received the sexually explicit emails from former pages, not from Democrats. However, listening to conservative radio last night, I heard Brian Ross excoriated because the accusation against him, the ABC News reporter, is that he held on to those emails for a while and is now just reporting on this when it's politically more powerful.
Well, certainly some political types on the right will make that argument, but they run a real risk, Robin, in making that argument of further enraging social conservatives, because for social conservatives, the issue is not how the story came to light, but the fact that it occurred in the first place. The Republicans have got a problem in trying to make sure that their base does not get disheartened, dispirited, and approach Election Day feeling like, what really is our reason for turning out to vote?
And it's so interesting, John, and I just want your take on this. Once again, you know, for all the news, the disheartening news about the war in Iraq, for all the other news, it seems as if once again we're approaching an election in America and sexual impropriety is more at the forefront.
Well, there's not much more gripping in a personal sense than personal sex scandals. We saw that in the Bill Clinton case. It's something that inevitably people are drawn to, that the media is drawn to. And unfortunately for Republicans, it's hard to imagine a worse combination with the storm over Iraq than to have something that really causes the calls into question the level of motivation and the attitude of the Republican base among social conservatives. They really need both the economic conservatives, the people who care about taxes and smaller government, and the people who are motivated by moral values, and they've got a real problem because of this Foley scandal in the latter.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. By the way, later we're going to have law professor Jonathan Turley. He'll talk about being a House page, he once was, and how he thinks the whole page program should be changed. John, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, we turn now to Asia, where one day after North Korea's announcement that it would carry out a nuclear test, that nation's neighbors, including China, have warned the regime in Pyongyang against that move. North Korea's move comes just as a new nationalist government is taking shape in Japan under the leadership of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. In Thailand, meanwhile, the interim government, which came to power after a coup last month, announced that it will hold power for 1 year, and there are no immediate plans to end martial law. And in the Chinese city of Shanghai, the highest-ranking member of the Communist Party has now been detained in an anti-corruption probe, the largest investigation of its kind since China started on the road to economic liberalizations 25 years ago. And many fear that the Chinese premier is using the investigation to purge his political opponents. So we felt good time to focus on Asia, and to help us make sense of some of the recent changes there, we have John Bussey, Asia editor for The Wall Street Journal, who's just off the plane from Hong Kong. Hello, John.
Pleasure to be here.
And Christopher Lockwood, who until this month was the Asia editor for The Economist. He joins us from his offices in London. Christopher, welcome to you as well.
Hello.
And John, I want to start with you and start with Japan. Fascinating backstory for this new prime minister, the youngest in post-war history, and the grandson of the prime minister who forged a treaty with the U.S. in 1960. What perspective does this give him?
Well, I think that what you're going to see in Japan is more of the same, what we've had so far with the prime ministership of Junichiro Koizumi. And by that, I do not mean stasis at all. These are reform-minded prime ministers, and by Japanese standards, they are actually reformers. Koizumi got a lot done. He forced the banks to offload a lot of their debt. He was quite assertive abroad. He privatized the postal saving system. And Shinzo Abe, the new prime minister, he says he's going to continue very much along the same lines, but perhaps have a softer side to the outside world, particularly to China.
Well, Christopher, we want to ask you about one difference that seems to jump out. Koizumi was heavily criticized for going to the famous shrine in Japan to the fallen Japanese soldiers. China, in particular, took offense because of Japan's occupation of China. Abe has not said if he will visit that shrine, and he is going to meet with the leaders of China and Korea.
Right. We don't know whether he's going to go to the shrine or not, but I think we can guess that he will have decided not to go. I think it's highly unlikely that he would have been able to secure the agreement of the Chinese to have the summit meeting and to have it at an early date had he not, through a back channel of some kind, given them an assurance that he will not be going to the shrine. If he does go to the shrine at any point during the next year, or really at any point in his premiership, I think that would immediately send Chinese-Japanese relations straight back to where they were under Mr. Koizumi.
And John Bussey, what does it mean that Abe says he's planning planning to meet with the leaders of China and South Korea, apparently before he meets with President Bush. Japanese leaders normally meet with the U.S. first.
Well, I think that the Japanese realize they have good relations with the United States, but they have some trouble in their own neighborhood. And as Chris points out, I mean, the relations with China have been fraught over the issue of the shrine, but also the assertiveness of Koizumi, a little bit of a kind of an in-your-face prime minister. I think down the road, though, Abe is going to have to bow in the direction of the right wing of his own party. We might be surprised. We might see after the parliamentary elections in July that he scoots off and pays homage at the Yasukuni Shrine.
Well, speaking of bowing to the right wing, there are concerns that Japan might be looking to, you know, have a shift in its military. To remind ourselves, by law, after the Second World War, Japan is not allowed a military. When it has troops, for instance, in Iraq, they can't fight, even to defend themselves. Chris, we're going to move from Japan soon, but do you see a shift there?
Yes, I absolutely do. The troops can fight to defend themselves, but they can't fight to protect anyone else. That's really the problem. So although they're allowed to look after Japan's own interests, they can't take part in collective security. Couldn't defend Americans, they can't defend civilians. And Koizumi started the process of trying to change this. It's something that makes his neighbours, particularly the Chinese and the South Koreans, extremely nervous for obvious reasons. And that's why it's extremely important that he maintains good relations with them, and extremely important that he doesn't go to the Yasukuni Shrine. If he plays it right, he ought to be able to make progress on this very important issue. If he plays it wrong, there won't be any.
Well, to the Koreas and to North Korea in particular, of course, it announced yesterday an intention to carry out a nuclear test. John Bussey, first of all, does North Korea have the capability to do so?
Well, the Bush administration says that it has some capability. We don't know whether it's got a bomb ready to set off in an underground bunker. It is more than coincidence, though, that the minister came out and sort of shouted across the world again that it was about to set off a bomb, just as their South Korean counterparts, the foreign minister in South Korea, advances toward becoming UN Secretary General. I think that this, in part, is once again Korea attempting to get a little bit of attention, but we just don't know, and that's one of the big problems. We don't know how far their nuclear program has advanced.
We want to ask you about South Korea's Ban Ki-moon, again, considered the leading candidate for UN Secretary General. But another question has been raised about the timing, that perhaps the timing of this announcement is to up the ante in the U.S., to force the Bush administration right before an election to make concessions to somehow quiet North Korea.
I'm not sure that you'd see the Bush administration making concessions to North Korea in advance of an election. If anything, I think they'd probably strike a harder line to sort of show that they are kind of standing up to what they consider one of the endpoints on the axis of evil. As far as Ban Ki-moon is concerned, that might be the best thing that could possibly happen to North Korea. This is a conciliatory individual, somebody who sought to have greater economic interaction and integration with the North. This is not somebody in South Korea who, as head of the UN, would be confronting North Korea.
And as you said, he is perhaps a leading candidate to be the new UN Secretary General. That's John Bussey, Asia editor for The Wall Street Journal, sounding terrific for having just deplaned from Hong Kong. Christopher Lockwood, until this month, the Asia editor for The Economist. We'll take a quick break and come back to ask more. What about this scandal in China? What does it all mean for Americans? Much more ahead here and now. Young, it's here and now, and we're focusing our gaze on Asia today with all of the headlines coming out of that region. We've been talking with John Bussey of the Wall Street Journal and Christopher Lockwood. He's the new U.S. editor of The Economist magazine. He was the former Asia editor. And Chris, I want to start with you and with China, a huge corruption scandal in Shanghai. Some would say, you know, kind of cheekily, well, what's new? And maybe what's new is that it's being called a scandal as opposed to business as usual. What is new? I mean, characterize this for us.
Well, it is very interesting that they're taking down somebody extremely important, the Party Secretary General of Shanghai, the largest and richest of China's cities. It's not the first time that something like this has happened. In Beijing in the 1990s, there was a similar case, again involving the party boss in Beijing. But this is much worse. It's a much bigger scandal. What's going on? Well, firstly, the Chinese government always wants to reassure foreign investors that it is tough on corruption, the main deterrent for increased investment in China. Secondly, though, it is almost certainly a move by the president of China, Hu Jintao, to marginalize the so-called Shanghai group, who were the supporters of the former president of China, Jiang Zemin, who comes from Shanghai. And there's a large group of very powerful Shanghainese people that Mr. Hu still has to deal with.
John Buzzi, tell us more about the politics of this, because some are comparing it to, you know, the kind of thing that Vladimir Putin has done in Russia.
Well, I think that Chris's assessment of it is, you know, on the mark, that this is an example of the central government trying to send signals to foreign investors. You got 120 foreign companies that base themselves in Shanghai. I mean, the city is, you know, 5% of the GDP. It's an enormously important economic center, but it's an enormously important political center, too, and the leaders there tended to go their own way very often, as in the case of that. So the housing bubble, the central government was saying, stop all the investment in housing. But in fact, the pension fund that's at the center of this corruption scandal was investing in a lot of property around Shanghai as a way to kind of further the growth of Shanghai. So how much of this is what they say, which is a investigation into possible corruption involving the $1.2 billion pension fund in Shanghai, along with a raft of other charges? And how much of it is really just trying to marginalize or eliminate your political rivals?
Which is, again, as we understand, Vladimir Putin has used that in Russia. And there's also questions about other aspects of China. We hear today that Human Rights Watch has organized an open letter to the president asking him to reverse a worsening crackdown on voices of dissent. Christopher, your thoughts?
Yes, it's one of the great disappointments about Hu Jintao. He's been in charge for a couple of years now, and there were great hopes, because he's a younger leader, that his reign would represent something of a liberalization. But actually, it hasn't turned out at all like that. There has been a concerted effort to suppress the media in particular, to attack websites, to attack people's personal email communications, and it's really a very depressing picture. Economically, the liberalization goes on. Politically, it's going backwards.
And it seems as if in some of the economic directions, it's running amok. John Bussey, just a quick comment. We're planning on doing a story down the road on something that we heard is happening in China, where a medical facility there is harvesting organs from prisoners, and was very upfront about it to a BBC reporter.
Well, this has been you know, charged for some time, and the government denies that this type of thing goes on. But I think that your point about an economy sort of running amok is an accurate one. It's something also that the central government is concerned about, which is that can you sustain 11% economic growth without having huge disjunctures and inequalities take form, beyond maybe the singular issue of, you know, the human rights and harvesting of organs, beyond that to how do you keep a country from splintering apart when you have several hundred million people benefiting from these economic reforms and 750 million people still on the farm.
Right. We're talking with John Bussey of The Wall Street Journal, Christopher Lockwood of The Economist. And while we have you in looking at Asia, we just want to spend a minute on Thailand. Chris, can you give me in a nutshell the meaning and impact of this recent coup? Thailand, a pivotal economy in Southeast Asia. We're reminded it was the collapse of the Thai economy a decade ago that helped set off the Asian economic crisis. But there's also a long history of military coups. So what is the outcome here, do you think?
To my mind, it's pretty depressing. Thailand has gradually and successfully freed itself from the shadow of military coups and the great domination of politics by the royal family. And this, I think, sets it back a long way. Now, it's true that the prime minister who was removed was not the best possible prime minister. There were very convincing allegations of corruption and interference in the machinery of government laid against him. That said, he had won several elections. He had won an election earlier this year, and that had been invalidated by the courts. Another one was going to be held. It would have been perfectly possible to remove him by democratic means had Thais been prepared to do that, and I find it very regrettable that the military decided not to wait for that.
Well, finally, in the couple minutes we have, we want to make a quick turn. It's admittedly Central Asia, but any time we can talk about Kazakhstan, we want to do that. The Kazakh president here last week, Dick Cheney, in Kazakhstan earlier this year. Critics saying the Bush administration making a huge compromise of its stated principles by allying with the Kazakh president. He's been so criticized for, among other things, suppression of democracy. A new film from the comic Sacha Baron Cohen says as much. So, Christopher Lockwood, why is Kazakhstan so suddenly so important?
Well, you know, Kazakhstan is a very interesting case. It does have plenty of resources, and obviously people want to make sure they can get a handle on that. And there's a competition between China and Russia and America for influence in that region. That said, it is not by any means as repressive a country as others in Central Asia, nothing like the atrocities that go on in Turkmenistan, say, or in Uzbekistan. So it's a delicate one. But I think it's probably right for the administration at least to meet with the president and urge him to open up a little bit. They do have elections there. They're just not very fair.
John Bussey, just a few seconds left. Back to the, you know, the general Asia region. Just if you could sum up in just a few seconds, I apologize, but it seems like it's a region in flux.
Well, it's a developing world, and you're going to have all sorts of bumps along the way. You're going to have coups in Thailand. You're going to have huge corruption charges in China. But if you step way back from Asia, it is a booming sector of the world economy. It is driving global growth now. It's a very positive story, and most of these nations have the best relations they've had with the United States ever.
John Bussey of The Wall Street Journal, Christopher Lockwood of The Economist, thank you both for helping us take a look at Asia today. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is in Arizona today, stumping for Republican candidates. As part of his visit, the president will sign the $35 billion Homeland Security Appropriations Act, which includes about $1 billion to start building a 700-mile fence along the U.S. border with Mexico. But that concrete and barbed wire fence is nothing compared to a virtual one already in the works that would ultimately cover 6,000 miles and rival the Great Wall of China. It's called the Secure Border Initiative Network, or SBINet. Boeing recently won the first phase of the contract, and joining us from Boeing is Robert Villanueva. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, the first phase of this contract, as we understand it, would cover 28 miles of the border, this near Tucson, Arizona, for an estimated cost of $67 million. It's set to be operational by next April. So what sort of technology is Boeing going to use?
We're going to be taking various technologies such as sensor systems and radars and cameras and things that have been used already and integrating them in a very unique way to have these technologies placed on the border that will be able to sense any type of motion or any object or person crossing the border and enable the Border Patrol agents to respond accordingly.
Well, Robert, what's it going to look like? I mean, we understand there are towers that are going to be involved. What will they look like?
Some of the assets include mobile and permanently fixed towers. The towers will have equipment mounted on them, such as the cameras, the radars, the sensor systems, and will place the towers in various strategic locations. And what they'll do is they'll enable the signal or the beacon of the sensor or the radar to extend as far out as they possibly can to sense any motion upon the border areas.
So it's a motion sensor. I have to ask, because when we hear virtual fence, a lot of people think of a dog fence. There's no shock involved here? There's no shocking of people trying to cross it?
No, nothing at all like that. Basically, it's just going to sense objects or individuals crossing the border, and hopefully we'll be able to identify exactly what it is, whether it's an animal or a human being.
Well, as you know, some experts have said that these towers with the sensors would lack the fiber optic cables to transmit video feeds. We're talking about going way into the desert. So how does this work exactly if the system is tripped? How would the Border Patrol know? I mean, would they actually be able to see?
We're going to be employing a combination of cameras and systems that are based on both wireless and hardwire connected connectivity systems. The system also is going to be administrated by a network that's going to enable everyone out in the field to have access to the same information at the same time. So whether you're an agent with a handheld device or an agent in a vehicle with a mounted display system or other organizations out in the field, everybody's going to have access to that same information. So the system will be up and running, and we don't anticipate any problems of the system going down.
So in places where you don't have cables to transmit video feeds, you say you're going to have wireless.
That's correct.
Right. Well, T.J. Bonner, who's president of the National Border Patrol, and they represent about 11,000 agents, he said knowing where people are crossing doesn't do any good unless he has enough people to respond on the ground, and he says he doesn't.
With with this system, we'll be able to monitor and track individuals or the object. And what that will enable the command centers to do at each sector along the border is to make the right decision with the best information and tell the agents, hey, it's a false alarm, or we need to send physical, you know, assets and people there to the scene to respond.
Well, this is, as you know, the second attempt at a virtual fence along the U.S. border. The U.S. spent $429 million on the Integrated Surveillance Intelligence System, that was ISIS. One of the companies that was involved in the ISIS was L3 Communications. It's also a Boeing subcontractor on your new virtual fence. The government's inspector general office criticized L3 Communications because their cameras failed when exposed to extreme heat or cold, which are found in the desert. So what's going to be different this time around with a company that failed last time?
L3 Communications is on our team, but we've actually been able to validate and prove the systems by all of our teammates that they do in fact work and under all the different extreme and diverse environments and geographic situations that they'll be having to work under.
Robert Villanueva, Boeing spokesperson, talking about the plan to start building a 6,000-mile virtual fence along the U.S. border. Quick question, Robert. I'd asked you earlier the derivation of your name, and your mom is Mexican, you said, and I'm just wondering, what do you hear from that community, the Mexican community, about this idea of building this fence?
Well, it's very interesting that you asked. We're in the process right now of doing our best to understand all the sensitivities and the issues that our customers, the Customs and Border Protection, and the Department of Homeland Security are facing, so that way we as a contractor can be as responsible and sensitive and responsive to the needs of all the communities that we're going to be doing work in along the northern and the southern borders.
Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, the Secure Border Initiative Network, or SBI Net, could end up costing more than $2 billion, but will it be able to stem the tide of illegal immigrants into the U.S.? Matthew Farr is Senior Homeland Security Analyst at the Frost & Sullivan Aerospace and Defense Group in San Antonio, Texas. Matthew, what do you think? We just heard Robert say that the technologies that Boeing will use will, for instance, get rid of false alarms, animal crossings, the cameras will work because of Wi-Fi. What do you think?
I think it's going to be very difficult. I think if there's any company that can make it work, Boeing is one of them. I think one of the most important aspects of this, though, whenever we look at SBI Net and Boeing, is they have not won a $2 billion contract yet. They won a $67 million contract to put their technology that they've proposed that can work along the Tucson border.
That's 28 miles, right?
For 28 miles. So they've got to demonstrate that their technology is going to work on 28 miles before they can move forward.
There was a previous attempt at this. We mentioned the ISIS fence that failed. They had, you know, 489 cameras. Half were never installed. 60% of the sensor alerts were never investigated. 90% of the alerts were false alarms.
I think that once you get into it, you're going to see the same sort of problems that you saw with ISIS. You're going to continue to deal with the false alarm rates. Working in the extreme heats and the extreme colds, I think power will be a problem. And I think making the intelligence actionable, you know, getting it into the people's hands in such a timely manner that it, you know, it allows you to get out there and do your job. But I think the problem that you're going to have is, okay, so you only go out whenever you detect somebody, but then what do you do with the person? Even if you do have enough agents to detain the people, what's the next logical step? What are you going to do then? I think the best example I ever heard was that you have to look at the border in the same way that you would a water dam, that it's going to overflow no matter how high you build that dam unless you allow it to be relieved through floodgates. And I think the border is the exact same way. Unless we allow a legal manner for the people that we need and are going to come over here regardless to come into the country, you're going to continue to see them crossing at the illegal borders.
Matthew Farr, Senior Homeland Security Analyst at the Frost & Sullivan Aerospace and Defense Group in San Antonio, Texas, talking about the planned 6,000-mile-long virtual fence to be built along the U.S. border. Matthew, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Couple quick notes still to come. Biologist E.O. Wilson's invitation to evangelicals to save the creation. We'll walk Walden Woods with him. Also tomorrow, New York Times columnist Frank Rich on the Iraq War, what he calls the greatest story ever sold. You're listening to Here and Now. as we said in our top story today, the congressional page scandal is growing instead of shrinking. For his perspective on the page program, we turn now to George Washington University Law School professor Jonathan Turley, who frequently helps us out with matters of Congress and the Supreme Court, but today he's here as a former page. In 1977, do I understand, Jonathan?
Yes, the medieval period.
Medieval meaning that unlike today when there are dorms, back then male pages had to find their own housing, female pages stayed at the YWCA. And Jonathan, you say that while there's a perception that incidents with pages are more common than they are, they did happen back then. You write in a New York Times opinion piece today that other pages once took you to the home of a D.C. man, not a congressman, who gave pages alcohol and drugs and photographed them semi-nude. You knew enough to leave.
Even at that age, I could see that this was not the place to be, and I left. He preyed not just on pages, but other boys. He would take into the woods and let them shoot guns and take their pictures and probably do other things.
Well, and you write that that man wasn't the greatest danger to the pages. The danger wasn't external, you know, some man in D.C. It was internal. It was inside Congress.
Yeah, you know, the fact is that Congress is representative of society in more ways than one. I mean, it has the same presence of pedophiles and predatorial members. Indeed, it may have more because of this sort of alliance between power and this type of conduct. But what is clear is that this is a constant problem and that the greatest danger to pages have come within Congress.
Well, and so what do you think should be done about this?
I think the solution is very simple, and that is the creation of what's called the Congressional Page Board, which would be composed of former pages who would look after the welfare of current pages.
As opposed to now where the House Page Board is made up of members of Congress, the Senate Page Board is composed of two Senate officials but no members, and you're saying make it completely outside Congress, make it former pages.
That's right, because these members of Congress have a built-in conflict of interest. These are the types of scandals that can rock not just an individual member, but his entire party, as we've seen. And this is a good example. You know, you have a guy who's sending emails to a 16-year-old boy, and, you know, they ask him, what are you doing? He says, he's mentoring, and they just basically let it go at that. I mean, you really had to do an aggressive investigation, look at all of his emails, which they apparently did not do.
But given that, given the Foley situation, what do you think about the calls to abolish the page program altogether?
Well, I think this is absolutely obnoxious. I mean, every time a member of Congress commits what is a crime in virtually all states, the call is to eliminate the page school as if to take away the temptation. It's basically an admission by members of Congress that we can't be trusted with children. And so it's much better just to remove the children than to try to deter our own criminal conduct. That's absolutely bizarre. I mean, the problem are the members of Congress themselves. The page service is going into its third century in this country.
And I want to ask you about that, Jonathan, because you write very powerfully about what it meant to be a page. You were 16. You served iconic figures such as Barbara Jordan and heard from Hubert Humphrey and walked out to hoist the flag on top of the House of Representatives. What was that like?
I remember being scared to death because the plank that you had to walk on was actually suspended. You know, you really took your life in your hands. But when I got to the middle of that plank, and there was just a single rope on one side that kept you from dying, I stopped, and all of a sudden I saw this great vista of Washington, D.C. And I remember standing there and holding that flag and looking out at that Capitol and feeling unbelievably empowered. And I think back all the time to that moment.
And apparently at that door where you go out to the top of the Capitol, the pages have recorded their names for over a century. Is yours there?
It is, in fact, and I'm probably going to be charged with vandalism of the Capitol. But I remember sitting down. It's actually these stairs that go up to this small door, and I sat on the stairs, and I just looked over to my left, and there was all these names. And you felt part of something that was much greater than yourself. That Capitol and those pages are one of the few unsullied aspects of Capitol Hill these days.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, and a House page from 1977 to 1978. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Thanks, Rob.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Let's see what we have here. We have termites, and that is a young queen.
And that is Harvard professor and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist E.O. Wilson, down on his knees in the dirt with us recently at Walden Pond in nearby Concord, Massachusetts. Oh, look at this nice old log.
Okay, watch for anything that moves.
Wilson has devoted his life to demonstrating how every species, no matter how humble, is a masterpiece of biology and worth saving. How even ants turn the earth as much as worms.
Ants swarming all over here. We've broken into that colony of ants, and they are peeved. They are not happy to be disturbed like that.
How many different kinds of ants are there?
There are 12,000 known by scientists. I figure twice that number in the world, at least.
But in his latest book, E.O. Wilson describes an ongoing biological catastrophe. He says at least half of the species of plants and animals on Earth could be gone or on their way to extinction by the end of this century. And most interesting, the book takes the form of an open letter to a fictional southern pastor, asking the religious to join the science community to save the Earth. The book is called The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. We thought it appropriate to ask about it, perched on an old log here at Walden, home to Thoreau and the American environmental movement.
You say that there's a basic fault line. People who believe on the one side of the fault line that the evolution of all life is independent of God. On the other side, a range of beliefs ranging from a denial that evolution ever occurred to acceptance that it did occur but that God had something to do with it. And you're saying that the goal should be just to accept that there's that difference?
Yes. I don't think that there's much chance of closing the gap. I feel we should stop wrangling over the unanswerable and recognize that the two most powerful forces in the world are religion and science, and that if they were combined in a common goal, there's very little that they could not accomplish. The one thing that really we do have in common is or should be the creation, the living creation, and that's the rest of life on Earth. We know, this is what the scientists contribute, that's disappearing rapidly. And on the side of the religious community, generally there is a commitment to save from destruction what they see as God's creations. Two worldviews, two reasons to save the creation. Why can't we combine them and not fuss about why we have them, but actually get busy and save the creation?
Well, and again, you say that the motivation for the religious-minded would be to save what's left of Eden, you know, the natural world. Mm-hmm. But many people who are fundamentalist in their faith believe that the Earth is just sort of a way station to another life, and in fact will be destroyed anyway when the rapture comes, so there's not the motivation to save it. What do you do about that?
This is one reason why I address the evangelicals in particular. Because at one extreme, there is the view of what are called the dispensationalists, namely those who take the word of the book of Revelation to be literally true. And so those who believe that we are just momentarily about to leave this planet, they certainly do not care much about the environment. But I venture to say that the vast majority of Christians believe otherwise, that we really must take care of what has been put into our care.
Whether or not we agree on how it got here.
That's right.
Yeah, you say in the book that, is the phrase secular humanist you use to describe yourself?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
The secularist is a person who is not identified with or has particular faith in any particular religion or denomination, but is an independent thinker. And humanist, this is the belief that humanity is at the center of things and that our activities should be primarily devoted to improving the lot of the human species.
And yet you have a lot of sympathy for the Southern Baptist pastor that you're writing this open letter to in your book. I mean, you grew up in Alabama. Were you a Baptist?
Yeah, I was raised as a Baptist, as a Southern Baptist, and drifted away from the faith at late in my teens to secularism. But I've grown up among Southern Baptists and others, fundamentalist Christians among them, and I deeply respect them. They are smart. Many of them are highly educated.
And the reason that you wrote it, though, I mean, is there a perception that if they perceived the environmental movement, let's say, as a liberal, secular movement, then they would feel cut off from it?
They do. They feel that way. It's a false theme. It's a canard that has been worked to the bone by the conservative right. There's a history to this, and very briefly in the 60s, the United States had a very a raucous and activist left. It also attacked the established order on the basis of neglect of environment, which is an easy thing to do. We didn't even have much of an environment ethic in the 60s. Well, that was very effective. In the Reagan years, a movement identified environmentalism as particularly dangerous, said the conservatives, because it was part of an effort to put a stranglehold on government with regulations. And that's where we are essentially today, but it has degenerated to rhetoric. The time has come to make the environment, especially conservation of the rest of life, nonpartisan.
So,
off record here, I suspect you may be sitting on an anthill.
I think I am. Do you mind? But, and I have a skirt on. So do
okay,
you mind?
So, oh, yeah. Bless my soul. It's a colony of carpenter ants. They're not swarming out. But shall we take a seat over here?
Well, I thought I felt something, but wait, let's look.
Yeah, they were coming up and investigating.
Yes.
Yeah, they wondered what this gigantic creature was that was disturbing their nest.
Okay.
Well, I feel
why
like
we
kept knocking your subject.
Other end of the
let's
lawn.
Do that. Okay. And well, I ask you. So now you've written this open letter to this pastor, this appeal to Southern Baptists in particular. Have they written you letters back?
Yeah. Already I've joined with a leading evangelical to have a conference later in the year between evangelical leaders and scientists to discuss the issues and explore the whole subject.
It's going to be perhaps a real challenge for each side not to try to proselytize the other.
I'd be happy if we just coaxed each other onto the common ground of being environmentalists.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for spending some time to tell us about it. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Robin.
E.O. Wilson, his book is called The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth.
By the way, I've always wanted to ask you this, one of your best-known books being The Ants. What did you think of Woody Allen's take on it? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was not the best introduction to the biology of ants. For one thing, all members of an ant colony are female. The males come in, and they have only one function. The daytime of the nuptial flight, that's when you see these winged ants flying all over the place. The males come forth and do the one thing they are constructed to do, and that is to mate with a queen, a virgin queen ant, and then they die.
And your problem is what?
It's this whole gung-ho superorganism thing that I, you know, I can't get. I try, but I don't get it. I mean, you know, what is it? I'm supposed to do everything for the colony, and what about my needs? What about me? I mean, I gotta believe there's some place out there that's better than this. Otherwise, I would just curl up in a larval position and weep. The whole system makes me feel insignificant.
Excellent. You've made a real breakthrough.
I have?
Yes, Z. You are insignificant.
I am?
You'll watch the movie Ants with new insight now. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.